You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Ta-Nehisi Coates called homegoing an inspiration, and I think you'll discover that for yourself when you read this debut novel by Yaa Jesse. Homegoing traces 300 years of family history in the country now called Ghana, and along the way, accumulates its power to create a monumental portrait of the forces that shape families and nations across the thread of time. Homegoing evokes folktales passed down from parent to child. One side of the family lives through slavery, Alabama's convict leasing system, the Great Migration, the Harlem Renaissance, and the heroin epidemic to the present day. On the other side of the Atlantic, the novel explores uncomfortable truths about the participation of Miss Jesse's Fante and Ashanti ancestors in the slave trade. It's a stunning tale and the shadow of the slave trade affecting both sides of a family who suffered for centuries. In West Africa, writes Jesse, near the turn of the 19th century, one of Afia's descendants dreams of fire shaped like a woman holding two babies to her heart. Yaa Jesse was born in Mampong, a small town 160 miles north of Cape Coast on Ghana's Gold Coast, the location where characters Afia and Essie were born. She left the country as a toddler and moved to the U.S. when her father was working on a PhD in French language at Ohio State University. The family lived in Illinois and Tennessee before settling in Huntsville, Alabama, the summer Jesse turned 10. She attended Stanford University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and now lives in the Bay Area. Ayanna A.H. Jameson, a writer, editor, and organizer, is our moderator for tonight's program. She last joined us at Aloud for a panel exploring the work of Octavia E. Butler. She is the founder of the Los Angeles-based Octavia E. Butler Legacy Network, a community organization that highlights the ongoing creative, scholarly, community, and social justice work inspired by speculative fiction author Butler. Jameson was also organizers of the Ferguson is the Future, Incubating Alternative Worlds Through Arts, Activism, and Scholarship Symposium at Princeton University. Her current book project is Octavia Butler's biography, based on Butler's own published and unpublished writing and her Southern California origins. Please join me in welcoming Yaa Jesse and Ayanna Jameson to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. Yaa is now going to read a selection from the novel, so please sit back and enjoy.
So I'm just going to read from the opening so I don't have to set it up. This chapter is titled Afia. The night Afia Otre was born into the musky heat of Fanti land, a fire raged through the woods just outside her father's compound. It moved quickly, tearing a path for days. It lived off the air. It slept in caves and hid in trees. It burned up and through, unconcerned with what wreckage it left behind, until it reached an Ashanti village. There, it disappeared, becoming one with the night. Afia's father, Kobi Otre, left his first wife, Baba, with the new baby so that he might survey the damage to his yams, that most precious crop known far and wide to sustain families. Kobi had lost 7 yams, and he felt each loss as a blow to his own family. He knew then that the memory of the fire that burned, then fled, would haunt him, his children, and his children's children for as long as the line continued. when he came back into Ba'aba's hut to find Afia, the child of the night's fire, shrieking into the air, he looked at his wife and said, "We will never again speak of what happened today." The villagers began to say that the baby was born of the fire, that this was the reason Ba'aba had no milk. Afia was nursed by Kobi's second wife, who had just given birth to a son 3 months before. Afia would not latch on, and when she did, her sharp gums would tear at the flesh around the woman's nipples until she became afraid to feed the baby. Because of this, Afia grew thinner, skin on small bird-like bones with a large black hole of a mouth that expelled a hungry cry, which could be heard throughout the village, even on the days Ba'aba did her best to smother it, covering the baby's lips with the rough palm of her left hand. "Love her," Kobi commanded, as though love were as simple an act as lifting food up from an iron plate and past one's lips. At night, Ba'aba dreamed of leaving the baby in the dark forest so that the god Nyame could do with her as he pleased. Afia grew older. The summer after her third birthday, Ba'aba had her first son. The boy's name was Fifi, and he was so fat that sometimes when Ba'aba wasn't looking, Afia would roll him along the ground like a ball. The first day that Ba'aba let Afia hold him, she accidentally dropped him. The baby bounced on his buttocks, landed on his stomach, and looked up at everyone in the room, confused as to whether or not he should cry. He decided against it, but Ba'aba, who had been stirring Benku, lifted her stirring stick and beat Afia across her bare back. Each time the stick lifted off the girl's body, it would leave behind hot, sticky pieces of Benku that burned into her flesh. By the time Ba'aba had finished, Afia was covered with sores, screaming and crying. From the floor, rolling this way and that on his belly, Fifi looked at Afia with his saucer eyes, but made no noise. Kobi came home to find his other wives attending to Afia's wounds and understood immediately what had happened. He and Ba'aba fought well into the night. Afia could hear them through the thin walls of the hut where she lay on the floor, drifting in and out of a feverish sleep. In her dream, Kobi was a lion and Ba'aba was a tree. The lion plucked the tree from the ground where it stood and slammed it back down. The tree stretched its branches in protest, and the lion ripped them off one by one. The tree, horizontal, began to cry red ants that traveled down the thin cracks between its bark. The ants pooled on the soft earth around the top of the tree trunk. And so the cycle began. Ba'aba beat Afia, Kobi beat Ba'aba. By the time Afia had reached age 10, she could recite a history of the scars on her body. The summer of 1764, when Ba'aba broke yams across her back. The spring of 1767, when Ba'aba bashed her left foot with a rock, breaking her big toe so that it now always pointed away from the other toes. For each scar on Afia's body, there was a companion scar on Ba'aba's. But that didn't stop mother from beating daughter, father from beating mother. Matters were only made worse by Afia's blossoming beauty. When she was 12, her breasts arrived, two lumps that sprung from her chest as soft as mango flesh. The men of the village knew that first blood would soon follow, and they waited for the chance to ask Ba'aba and Kobi for her hand. The gifts started. One man tapped palm wine better than anyone else in the village, but another's fishing nets were never empty. Kobi's family feasted off of Afia's burgeoning womanhood. Their bellies, their hands, were never empty.
Thank you. So I'd just like to start by saying these characters that we have all been introduced to are just the tip of the iceberg. How do these people in the novel come to inhabit your imagination and your writing process?
Sure. So the novel began for me with a trip to the Cape Coast Castle that I took my The summer between my sophomore and junior years, I had received a grant from Stanford to travel to Ghana and do research for a novel. And I'd had kind of a different idea in mind, but then I got there and I wasn't as interested in that. And a friend came to visit and we decided to go to the Cape Coast Castle. And it was while there on the tour that the tour guide started to talk to us about the fact that the British soldiers would often marry the local women, which was something I had never heard about before. And then from there, the guide took us down into the dungeons to see where they kept the slaves before sending them along the Middle Passage. And I thought, you know, that juxtaposition was so striking, the fact that there could be women above the castle who weren't aware or maybe didn't understand what was to become of the women who lived below. And so this book really started with that, those two women that begin the novel, Afia, who is the wife of the British governor of the Cape Coast Castle, and Essie, who is her half-sister who's kept in the castle as a slave. And those two chapters I wrote basically as you see them. And then from there, I made a family tree that I put on the wall of my apartment above my desk. And the tree just had either woman on either side of the page, and then the name of the descendant, gender if I knew it, and then also the years during which the bulk of their chapter would take place in, and then maybe one historical, political thing that was happening in the background during that time period. So the beginning of cocoa farming in Ghana, or the Great Migration, whatever it was. And that was the kind of the thing that I used to launch off into my research whenever I began a new character.
And so are these things that you knew sort of already, or were there things that you researched to put them up on the family tree?
Some of the things I researched to put them up on the family tree, there's a chapter that takes place right at the second half of this book, H's chapter, which follows the convict leasing system in Alabama, which was something that I knew very little about, had never really heard about before, and it was just kind of while studying post-Civil War South that I came upon this and kind of, you know, changed the direction of his character and of that chapter.
That chapter has stayed with me all this time since I first read the novel, but I also think about the cheese and the other artisanal foods that are made for Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and other places by convict labor
right.
today, right?
Right.
So throughout my reading of the book, there were so many things that were identifiable. And I'm wondering if your growing up in Alabama helped to kind of illuminate some of those aspects of the book, or whether you think that it was separate, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to preface what I'm saying. You were born in Ghana and then moved here when you were very young.
Right.
So I wonder how your identity and your consciousness about culture sort of played into how the book evolved.
Yeah. So I was born in Ghana. I lived there until about age 2. And then we moved to Ohio, Illinois, Tennessee, and then Alabama when I was 9. And so I was always kind of like very displaced, didn't have like a great sense of my identity. I read a lot of books, was very shy, that whole thing. But also everywhere that we moved, we ended up kind of living in predominantly white areas. And so I didn't have a real sense of myself as an African American in this country. I didn't have like the kind of cultural markers that a lot of people have. In Alabama, when we got there, we didn't really even have an African immigrant community, which we had had in every other place before that. There weren't a lot of West Africans in Alabama when we moved there. There are now a lot more. My mom's actually president of the Ghana Association of Huntsville. so it's grown. But, you know, I think I grew up kind of feeling not Ghanaian enough for Ghanaians, not black enough for Americans, trying to, like, understand where I fit in and feeling as though I was kind of straddling two cultures but didn't have ownership of either culture, couldn't fully identify in either culture. And so that trip to Ghana was really kind of just about getting a sense of my own roots, feeling kind of more connected on a personal level to my own family's background. And I think this book is
100% like a project that is about trying to navigate what it means to be Black in America, what it means to kind of have this identity as both an immigrant and an African American,
And first generation,
and right,
and a daughter,
first generation,
and only daughter, which right. is a whole other
right,
thing.
Exactly.
So, what do you think? Out of that experience in Alabama, and you said you earlier at dinner you started writing the book in 2009.
Right.
What I was wondering while I was reading is what other cultural events happened that you think may have played into or you've become aware of while you were writing?
Mm-hmm.
Because 2009 to now, it's like a whole different universe, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been getting questions about whether like Black Lives Matter has influenced this book and things like that. But when I started the book, that movement wasn't happening.
Right.
And so there's a lot of conversation happening now that's really that's really tied to a lot of the things that I talk about. And I think writing this book was kind of a lesson in how much repeats in our history over and over again. There's a chapter in this book, Sunny's chapter, that touches very lightly on the Harlem riots of 1964 that were started very much like all of the uprisings that have been started in recent years. A young Black boy was killed by the police. And so we see these kinds of things repeat over and over again, and we have like kind of, a light conversation about it in the moment, and then it kind of peters off and we forget that we've already been here. We keep coming back to these places. And so I think this novel was kind of me trying to excavate all of that stuff and bring it out and connect it all.
And it was a huge project, and I understand how it must have taken a long time. But it seems also there's a lot of upheaval and violence in the novel and really graphically upsetting things, yet it's so compelling. The characters and the things that happen to them and how they feel kind of gets to you. Like, I would be thinking about characters, I would read at night after my kids had gone to bed, and the next day I would think all day about the characters and what was happening to them, and just wishing that I could meet them, or conversely, that they were my own relatives, right?
Right.
So when you say the word excavate, it really feels like a historical excavation, like an archaeological dig. And then for me, I want to have them in the future, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, what happens to them at the end? And I wonder, how do you feel after having completed the project and how these characters sort of live with you now, or what is that process like of being done with the book?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's an accident that when we talk about families, we use terms like trees and roots and, there's so much that we don't know, that we don't see, that's kind of below the surface. All of these things that we're kind of inheriting that maybe we aren't aware of. And so that was something that was really on my mind while I was writing this book.
And this is not autobiographical, and there are no people in your family tree, as far as you know, that had this experience.
Right. Yeah, I didn't try to look, though. I was just kind of like, I don't want to know.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I'm also wondering if you have a favorite character, if there's something that you really enjoyed writing, even in the midst of all of the grief and the trauma and the repetition of history that's there.
I guess if I had to pick a favorite character, I think I like them all, but I think, mostly I just remember like what I was kind of learning and the space I was kind of in as I was writing each character, and so each one brings a different fondness. But I am particularly fond of Willie, a character in the second half of the book who's kind of a part of the Great Migration. She goes to Harlem with her family. She wants to be a singer, and then she ends up having this religious experience where she decides to start singing for her church and.
She decides after someone has the paper bag contest, comparison, she's too dark to sing in a Harlem nightclub.
Right, yeah.
I mean, you hear about that, right?
Right.
But to read that someone was literally compared to a paper sack, like, a very visceral experience.
Yeah. And that chapter for me was kind of all about colorism within the Black community because, you know, you have Willie, who's darker than a paper bag and isn't allowed to sing at this nightclub, but then you have her husband, who is light-skinned enough to pass as white, which she chooses to do. And so that chapter was kind of, I don't know, for me, just kind of thinking about the mutability of it all and how ridiculous race is ultimately, you know, that the lighter skinned you are, the kind of the deeper connection you have to whiteness, which kind of allows you this different access to things in American society that darker skinned people do not have.
Unless you're an immigrant.
Unless you're
special.
An immigrant.
You're the magical,
right. Exactly.
Non-regular
you're the unicorn.
Right. And I think one of the things that stood out to me was the issue of gaze. There's not one instance or one character in which the person who is reflecting is, there's no white gaze in this book. There may be snippets and moments where there's a character that's narrating, but I found it remarkable and refreshing. Can you talk a little bit about, was that a conscious choice or something that automatically happened?
I think it was a little bit of both. Like I had always known that I didn't want to center whiteness at all in this book. I didn't want it to be about white people. I wanted it to be about me and my people. So I was kind of coming to this book as both audience and writer. You know, the audience was me. It was people who were kind of existing in this area where they wanted to know more about what connected Africans and African Americans. I wanted if there were any white people in the book for them to have kind of a peripheral role and not be the focus of the chapters or of the novel.
But at the same time, the Dutch and the British, their influence and the sort of aftermath and the mess of I don't know how you could live with the reality of slavery, right?
Right.
And the sort of African complicity, is that a word?
Yeah.
Like that was so much of a struggle for me, so heartbreaking to read.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really complicated because you know, the different ethnic groups that were complicit in the slave trade were at the same time being exploited by the British, by the Dutch, by whatever Europeans were there. So it was this dual thing of, you know, everyone's greed kind of coming to a head and causing just a lot of turmoil. And then because I think the groups in West Africa couldn't see the results of this trade, they weren't there, they didn't have access to what happened after, all they had left was British colonialism or whatever the seat of power was for them. And so they're fighting against that at the same time. And so I think it's just this web of exploitation across the board.
Except though that the scale is different, right? Because
right.
Folks in their compound that are then eating when there's a drought, it's not the same as someone
right.
trafficking in humans and living in the castle and having his wife
right.
at home. That's
exactly.
A whole different level of scale.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I could see some folks reading this and feeling like, oh, that can't be true. We didn't sell one another into slavery. And really struggling or feeling resistant to it. Is there any other resistance that you think that people might have to reading the novel based on some of your interactions with folks?
I think the complicity aspect has been the thing that people are most resistant to. You know, if you get a chance ever to take a tour of this castle, I really recommend it because it really puts to rest any question you might have had about what exactly was going on. It seems like not a useful thing to me to deny that there was complicity on the African side, and not saying that as a way to, you know, just ascribe blame, because I don't think that they were to blame. Again, I think you
right.
know they were a part of this really Cons kind of
in a larger
exactly, and so that has been the thing that I think a lot of people have been kind of you know, taken aback by or resistant to.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this story is really rich from a female perspective.
Mm.
And I feel like when there are male characters, do we have a cricket? Wow. That's a persistent ring. Is it okay? And you're sitting right in the middle, so it's not like you can get out and go answer your phone. So the thing that I found very powerful is also that it's told from the perspective of women. And I feel that very often in African-American literature, even when it's a female author, that very often the people that are agents of their own destiny are often the male characters, mm-hmm. which is something that you also circumvented. Mm. And was that intentional?
Yeah, I always knew that I wanted, you know, the family tree to start with two women, but just because of this situation of the British soldiers marrying the local women and having female slaves underneath the castle, like that image was really strong to me. But at the same time, the Akan people of Ghana are matrilineal, so it made sense to start with two women because that's kind of how we follow our family trees.
Mm. That I didn't know. Yeah. I think I accepted it as fact, right? See, I read the novel and accepted that this was the fact, right? Rather than the exception, which is a testament to how well you did, right? Because yeah. it was not anything I could be consciously aware of, other than I cared so much about the characters. Mm. And even hearing you read the opening again, it like breaks my heart again, right? So I am a scholar of literature, yeah. among other things. And I have a psychology background. And so I see all of these images like fire and water and earth.
Right.
And I wonder if you could tell us more about how those elements and maybe indigenous African cultures, like these are things that African Americans are largely ignorant of, right? Mm-hmm. Even as a scholar.
Yeah.
How did fire become that element that burned throughout?
Yeah. So the image of the first chapter, the first image that appeared to me kind of fully formed for this novel was that of a woman setting a really big fire, which you get a little bit of that in the passage that I read. And so kind of the villagers say that Afia is born of this fire and that she like takes on the fire's characteristics and all of this stuff. So I kind of started to think of Afia's family line as children of this fire. And then on Essie's side, the other half-sister's side, she's taken along the middle passage. All of her descendants have this complicated relationship to water, this fear of water. And I thought, you know, it was nice to kind of have something to juxtapose against that fire. So these two elements, fire and water, kind of made up the family line. Afia's children are the children of this fire, and Essie's children are the children of this water.
So they're both images of rebirth,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, how do you situate your writing? Because I always want to find the Afro future, right? Yeah. Because for me, it's as if we talked at dinner about Kindred, Octavia Butler's Kindred, and always wondering what would happen if those characters could have a bird's eye view, which is what is in your novel. Mm. So I'm wondering, what do you think? What do you think scholars will say in 15 or 20 years about how they're characterizing your debut?
Oh, man.
It's a big question. It's a big question.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I think it's been interesting now to kind of hear people try to figure out whether to call this an African novel or an African-American novel, and kind of trying to situate me on the bookshelf, you know, where does it go? And, you know, I'm happy to have a
just
novel
to be
that's...
I'm happy to be on
the bookshelf, first of all. But then happy to have, like, a conversation about diaspora, because I think something that has been missing in a lot of the African literature that's been popular in America is a conversation about diaspora, about African-American experiences. Americana is a book that did that beautifully, I thought. And I was really, really interested in that conversation as a Black person who didn't spend most of my life in Africa, you know. So I didn't have like a full sense of myself as a Ghanaian. So when I am writing, I can't just write only about Ghana, I feel. So I'm not sure where they'll put me eventually, but hopefully, you know, there will start to be more pieces of literature around kind of not just immigrant literature, but literature around diaspora, African diaspora.
And are there any other texts that you read or have been inspired by or in conversation with that you can think of? Like when I, like now that I'm done with this, I cannot keep reading it. What else can I read?
Well, the book that I read pretty much right before I wrote the version that looks like this was 100 Years of Solitude by Garcia Marquez. And that was a great book to read before embarking on a big family tree kind of novel. Mostly just because, you know, he gets away with so much in that book, so much that we tell young writers that they shouldn't do. And so, you know, I kind of felt when I read that I suddenly had permission to just do whatever I wanted and just, you know, see what happened after that. So I think that's a good one to go to next if you haven't read it.
I have not read that yet. Yeah. And is it epic, the way that your book is epic?
Oh, yeah. Maybe even more so. I don't know.
I feel like, speaking of diaspora, that there is maybe some kind of, I don't want to say, Renaissance is so cliche, right?
Mm.
But there certainly is sort of a millennial, or there's like some kind of uprising of literature that's coming from younger people. It's not someone who's been in the academy or writing African or African-American fiction for decades and have been the editor of this and that.
Yeah.
Do you think that you have some contemporaries that are writing that perhaps we don't know yet? Do you think there's a resurgence of youth writers, or what do you think the climate is? Because it feels different,
yeah.
Right?
I don't know if there's a resurgence of youth writers. Something that I have been noticing is people who are taking a much longer view of history as it pertains to the African American experience in America. They're kind of looking at a political point very closely over a very long period of time. I'm thinking of something like The Case for Reparations, Coates's work,
yes.
Or Nicole Hannah Jones's work around school segregation, or Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, you know, kind of looking at these different segments of things that have impacted Black people in America, but looking at it over a very long period of time. I'm not sure if I've noticed the youth thing, though.
Meaning someone that's, like, under 50. I don't know. As I age, the scale changes.
Right.
But I do think there is something to be said for what happens when one gets older and buys the house and lives in the suburbs, right?
Mm.
That political thread or that fire kind of shifts in the time and different things. Like, I don't know if someone who is much older would have the same... it wouldn't have the same impact, right?
Mm.
They would write a different novel after going to the castle. Mm. And was that your first time back to Ghana or just your first time there?
No, that was my second time back to Ghana. I had gone back with my entire family the summer after sixth grade, so I was probably 11. And that was kind of the first time that I met all of my extended family, my aunts and uncles, my grandparents for the first time. And it did feel like, you know, a real homecoming, kind of a chance for me to feel like I was a part of this larger community, which I didn't have here and that a lot of immigrants don't have here, you know, and have to create for themselves by meeting other immigrants.
And there's no internet in the beginning of the book, right?
Right.
There's always a sense, but there's always a sense, though, that one is not alone.
Yeah.
And I think that's the gift that your book gives, is that it makes me feel like even though I don't know my relatives on the African-American side, that they existed and that they lived full lives.
Right.
And I don't know how you could effectively take, you know, 10 or 20 pages and write a whole lifetime and give someone characteristics and details.
Mm.
Can you tell us whether or not there's a character that was the least fun to write, or one that was the most difficult to become acquainted with during this process?
Yeah, the character that was the most difficult to write was the third character, Quay's chapter of this novel. He's the son of the British governor and the Fanti wife, and it was difficult because I couldn't find a lot of research material around these children, the children of these unions. I didn't really know what became of them after they happened. Like, some books would kind of give a couple of sentences about how they could sometimes be sent to
England for school, and then they would come back. But it was the only time during the process of writing this that I felt really stifled by the research. Like, if I didn't know, you know, what color shoes they might have been wearing in that time period, I couldn't write it, you know? And so I wrote about half of that chapter and then just had to stop and skipped ahead. And that's the only time that I didn't write chronologically. And his chapter really suffered for it, I think. It wasn't that great in the beginning. And then it's the only chapter that I ended up completely rewriting. It's like, okay, I just need to kind of shake up my imagination and stop being so stilted and so focused on this, you know, this particular idea. And he's a lot better for it. That chapter is a lot better for it.
But it does make me wonder about sort of the precariousness that continues to exist when we talk about multiracial children or mixed race children.
Yeah.
And the debate about, like, is Obama black? Is he right. African American? Is he African?
Right.
And I bet people ask you this question too, right? If you're in a predominantly white space, people want to know what you think about Obama, right? In 2007. But this is it's interesting that particular character would be difficult because it's still sort of an open-ended question, right?
Yeah.
Diaspora, you know, we want to invite everyone to the cookout, right? Mm. Or everybody's on Black Twitter, but then we have Rachel Dolezal, right? We have people that we're questioning, like, could she really be Black? Is she claiming that? So there's a question of identity that maybe it's such a difficult piece to embody for that character,
yeah.
I would imagine.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, you know, the term that people used for these mixed race children was half caste. Literally, you are half of each caste. You know, you're not like this whole complete person. That term has gone out of favor, I think rightfully so. But yeah, I think, you know, Quay is unique in this book in that he is kind of, you know, he's both a child of privilege and power and a child of the village. And how does he navigate both of those experiences?
And in some cases, he doesn't,
yeah.
Right? So where do you see this kind of epic, long view writing going? Are you in any writing groups? Do you share? I'm just wondering about your process, right?
Yeah.
Because you've talked about being in your apartment and having the family tree and doing research. But in what kind of dialogue and relationships were you in during the writing of the novel?
Well, I wrote the bulk of the novel as you see it now when I was getting my MFA at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And so I had a really wide community of other writers who were reading my work and giving me feedback on that work. Sometimes it was a little too much, you know? And so,
for example, you don't have to name names, but I'm curious, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious about what is unhelpful advice and what is helpful, because there are probably aspiring writers or people that have books in them that are looking at you wondering, how can I do what she did?
Yeah, I think it's hard to
say it without naming names. No.
I think the most unhelpful is when you get a sense that the person is trying to tell you what kind of book they would want to write. You know, they're not talking about your book. They're telling you, like, their better idea that they thought of while reading your book, which is not at all helpful.
No.
And then when you're workshopping a novel, it can be difficult, too, because you can't do the entire thing at once, and so people are only getting to see bits and pieces, and then they start like thinking about what might happen instead of what is happening, and so that can kind of be hard too. I think that when you feel a connection to a reader, it's really about someone who is invested in your idea, who sees what you're trying to do, and wants to help you get there.
So find your people. That's part of advice,
yeah,
right?
That's
find
exactly
people that
it.
Are not going to write your novel as if they would write it.
Yeah.
And then I want to ask also about your short story that also has the theme of fire. And where did that come along the process?
Yeah, I probably wrote, I think you're referring to Inscape.
Yes.
Which is a short story that I have in Guernica.
I took breaks while I was writing this book because I didn't want to workshop all of it. So I would write some short stories to turn in to class so that I could kind of work on this quietly by myself. And
keep people out of your business because you'd had enough. I see what you...
Exactly. Yeah. And Inscape was one of those stories, and it kind of just came about from just me thinking about religion, but also thinking about the poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins, who was kind of one of the first poets that I really liked when I was young and first starting to get into poetry. And he has a lot of fire imagery in his work, and so I think I was kind of playing off of that in that story.
But there's a lot of crossover. So you can find that short story, and I think you'll really enjoy it. And it's almost like it's in a parallel universe, right? Mm. That the power behind the fire in Homegoing is the same elemental power behind the fire of, I want to say, rebirth, right?
Yeah.
So you have many images of rebirth, and I'm wondering if you think there's sort of an underlying message of sort of rebirth and our interest in diaspora that's not, that doesn't co-opt an African history that we may not know that we have, right? Because we've had that, and that's very well illustrated in Americana, right? Mm-hmm. The person wearing the onks, like she goes to the party and she sees. But what do you think the underlying kind of message or gift is, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, something that I just kept encountering when I was thinking about this book was one of the huge tragedies of slavery, I think, was the fact that it left so many families just completely fractured. You don't know where you came from. You don't know who your family was here in this country. But then beyond that, you don't know where you came from on the continent, you know? So you can't even go back and kind of have this richness of experience with your people, with your ancestors, and kind of learn what the customs are around that. So I was kind of always thinking about the ways in which families fracture, African-American families fracture, and this book felt like a project in restoring that, you know, restoring that broader family, so that even though these characters don't get to know that they are a part of this fuller family, we know it. And so when we're reading their stories, you know, we bring all of that to them. The last two characters, Marcus, who is an African-American, and Marjorie, who is a Ghanaian immigrant, you know, their stories are richer, I think, because we have had this 250-year experience with the rest of their family. And so many of their traits we see in their ancestors, and so many of the things that they're concerned with, we know why they're concerned with them, even if they don't know.
Yes, and also the physical... I don't like to spoil, but there's a talisman or an artifact that each sister has, and one sister loses it, right? And this, like, made me cry when I was reading. Mm. That part of her personhood is stripped away in those dungeons.
Yeah.
That she's no longer a person. She's not allowed to own anything. Instead, she becomes the commodity.
Yeah.
And the talisman is somehow almost recovered. And that's a constant thing, right? So even home ownership or jewelry or property or assets are not things that many people can pass down, not just because of the subprime mortgage crisis, right?
Right.
But because historically we have not been able to, we've been redlined and different things. And so when you said that everything in Harlem, even though it was the black side of town, was owned by white people, that was like another kind of gut punch because we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
Can you say where you found that information and how you decided to... You gave us a whole history, right, in just that one fact.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I found that particular information. I was working with a lot of different research texts. For the beginning chapters, there was a book called The Door of No Return that kind of talked about life in the castle in and around the time period that I'm talking about. It had a chapter on women and children and kind of gave the layout of the castle. And then I moved on towards books like Black Prisoners and Their World by Mary Ellen Curtin, or The Fonte and the Transatlantic Slave Trade was a book I used. I tried to kind of get myself situated in as much as I could into the time period that I was writing about.
And is there anything that you had to extrapolate besides Quay's chapter any other gaps in the scholarship that you had to fill in?
There are a lot of gaps in the scholarship, particularly for the Ghanaian chapters, for the earlier Ghanaian chapters. You know, the British brought the written language when they came, and so a lot of people did not have the opportunity to write their own stories. I'm sure they were telling them, but they didn't get to, you know, make this record of it. And so so those early chapters were really kind of just it was freeing in a way, because there was so little about these people that I kind of could do whatever I wanted. But then I felt like a deeper responsibility to them, because in real life they wouldn't have been able to say, you know, what was going on, what they were feeling, what was happening to them.
That's kind of heartbreaking, right? Yeah. So you're experiencing that sort of disenfranchisement or displacement, right?
Yeah.
At the same time as your characters are.
Yeah.
Though it doesn't read that way, but I'm just saying as a researcher who researches archives, right? I can imagine your notes and all of the books and everything are, you know, numerous.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're doing an MFA program living away from home. Writing short stories to turn in for class to get people off your case. and all of those things at the same time.
Yeah.
What in life has changed now that you're touring with a book rather than... when did you complete writing it, and how did things shift after that?
So I finished a first draft of it like a few weeks after I graduated from Iowa. So like in 2014. Yeah, that's right. And then I spent probably... 8 or 9 months revising it before I sent it out to anyone. And then the process after it was bought has been like about a year and a half. So that's the timeline for how long it's been going. I think this part of my career is very new, obviously. Like, as a writer, I think most people most writers would agree that you spend so much time alone, you know, in front of your desk, kind of just quiet and lonely. And now you have to like have a more public facing face, which is, you know, it's different. It's a different set of skills, I think, than what you bring to the table when you're writing.
And I want to ask, in addition to not having the white gaze, one of the things that I struggled with is the African American gaze, right? Mm-hmm. And also feeling like I wanted to root for them, and I wanted them to have agency, because I was so heartbroken about all of the things that were acting upon them.
Yeah.
And I wonder in hindsight, do you think that was the case, or what would be your impressions?
Yeah, I don't know. I was trying to balance both sides of this, you know, larger family. I think it's interesting. I think it's going to be interesting to kind of hear the different people talk about the book. Ghanaians talk about the book, and African Americans talk about the book, because I think they're coming from these different vantage points. You know, when I said earlier that I didn't feel Ghanaian enough for Ghana and African American enough for America, I think that, you know, that comes into the writing in a way. You know, you kind of see me straddling these two sides and trying to tell their stories with equal weight. And so I'm not sure, but it'll be interesting for me to kind of see people start to encounter this book and see what kind of conversations pop up around that topic.
I agree, and I think we have some time for questions. So we have a question up here up front, and it'll just take us a moment. We're starting questions a couple of minutes early, because I feel I can see people nodding, and I can feel you all moving on the edge of your seats. So we're going to get this down to you. And who's going to be next? So let's move to the back and then to the center here.
Yes, greetings.
Hi.
And welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I haven't read the book yet, and I'm looking forward to it. So I will hopefully let you know about the African American.
That's perfect.
but what I wanted to ask you was, I heard you all talking about the elements and the things that you use to, you know, give character to the book and the characters in the book. Mm-hmm. And she asked you a little bit about who influenced you. I was wondering, as a writer, did any of Achebe's work or some other Africans and some other African Americans' work have any influence in terms of their style and the way that you formed your style in coming up with this story?
Yeah.
That's an excellent question.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Achebe's influence is inescapable. You know, he's just a master at what he did. And when you read Things Fall Apart, it's really hard to not be blown away by both the fact that the style of that book, the prose of that book, is so simple, and yet he's working on such a huge idea, such a huge project. And that's something that I definitely borrowed or took with me from him. Morrison is a huge influence of mine. I love her work. And Baldwin is another huge influence of mine. You know, I grew up Pentecostal in the South. And I think, you know, just anytime I read anything that he's written around religion, I'm always just enraptured.
Hi. I'm all seated. Thanks for being here tonight.
Yeah.
So I had two questions. The first is, you mentioned when you went to Ghana for the second time and you visited the castle, you were thinking about a completely different book idea. So I was curious if you could share what that idea was, because I'm just nosy. I pick up things like that. And then my second question is a little longer, so I hope I phrase this in a way that makes sense, but it sounds like, I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, there's a lot of focus on, like, rebirth and, like you said, taking a long-form view of history and how things are cyclical and how we repeat these cycles. So in writing the book, did you get depressed by this, or did you find hope? And if you did find hope, like, what were those kernels of hope? Or, you know, more than a kernel.
So to answer your first question, I just had like a very vague idea about writing a book that kind of centered around mothers and daughters. My mother grew up, my mother's a Fanti, and she grew up in the central region of Ghana. And so my idea was just to kind of go to my mother's area of Ghana and kind of just feel myself around and see if, you know, see if anything came up for me, and nothing really did, except that I went to the castle. So I guess, you know, in a way it did. And then the second question, I don't know, I felt like the entire time that I was writing this, I felt like, you know, as bad as it could ever be for me to write this, or for any of you to read this, there were people who were living it. And so I had a responsibility to not look away from them, you know, to not look away from their pain, and to not look away when the moments got hard. And so I think, you know, I definitely felt it, but at the same time, I wanted to do them some justice and to represent them, you know, as fully rounded and nuanced and complexly as I, complexly is not a word, as I could. Yeah.
We also had one up in the center after that.
Hi. So I appreciated your book and that it just really ignited once again in me a real longing for that history as an African American. It's like I wanted, you know, I want to know. And I also thought that the themes that you brought up around, you know, women and motherhood and mothers and daughters, but specifically around mental health and religion and the way that those themes just kept coming back in the characters' lives. And frankly, you know, when I read about, you know, our history, our shared history and things that happen, you know, I'm just always surprised that, like, all of us aren't crazy. But, you know, like, really, seriously. And you know, you brought that mental health aspect in along with religion in ways that, you know, really linked them as a savior, and then also as, you know, a sacrifice as well. And so I just wanted to know more about your thought process around those two areas.
Yeah, I don't know how anyone withstood any of this, you know? And so what were the things that brought them comfort? What were the things that brought them joy? And religion is one of those things for a lot of African Americans. You know, this this thing that restored something to them. And so in a chapter like Willie's chapter, when she comes to the church after she's lost so much, I feel for her. I feel for her in those moments when she's singing and when she feels like something has been restored. And I think I was kind of always trying to find those moments for these characters who were losing so much. How do you stay mentally healthy? How do you keep going? What is it that allows you to press forward?
I want to follow up on something that I forgot to ask earlier about acceptance after a huge break in fantasy, like all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a model for how an indigenous way to care for someone after a huge mental health crisis? Like, where did that come from? I think I understand the roots of her question, but there was no religious structure, right?
Yeah,
no. In that particular section of the novel, yet she lives to be a grandmother.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I had a model for that, or if it was just
organic.
Organic, yeah. Just thinking about, you know, what it might feel like, trying to deeply imagine what it might feel like for a character like that.
No spoilers. That's why I'm being vague. No spoilers, because I hate when people do that. So we have a question right here in the center.
Oh,
we had a question right here in the very. Okay, good.
Hi.
Hi.
Just want to say I'm a huge fan. I've been for years. I was wondering if you could actually do the name pronunciations for the main characters.
Oh, sure. I'll just use the family tree. So, Mame, Kobi Otre, and Big Man Asari. Afia Otre and Essie Asari, James Collins, Quay Collins, and Nanaya Yeboa, Ness Stockham, James Richard Collins, and Akosia Mensa, Kojo Freeman and Anna Foster, Abena Collins and Ohinen Yako, Agnes, Beula, Cato, Daly, Urias, Felicity, Gracie, H, and Etha Jackson. Aquia Collins, Asamwa Ejikum, Abna, Amasawa, Yao Ejikum, Esther Amawa, Marjorie Ejikum. I think the rest you can get on the American side.
But speaking their name makes them real, right? Like, if we could speak the names of our ancestors that were taken away by the Nazis or that were annihilated Native Americans. So there's some power in speaking their names and naming them, even if they don't, in fact, exist for us.
Right.
Yeah. Hi, yeah. My name is Mahal. I'm really excited about you and your book.
Thank you.
And I grew up in Ethiopia. I'm Ethiopian, but then came to the U.S. for college.
Mm.
And I keep going back. And I think that itself is a completely different group of people who are having very interesting experiences, because a lot of my friends, myself included, were going back home.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what your hopes are for this book in the continent. Are you hoping to promote it in the region? Have you had any, I guess, discussions with writers who are based in Africa? Thank you.
That's a great question. I would love to go to Ghana with this book at some point. Nothing is on the table yet, but I'm hoping that once things calm down with my U.S. tour, that it'll extend outward to other places. Yeah.
Hi. My name is Sonora. And in the world of like television and film, I know there's been like a lot of discussion between the Roots remake, 12 Years a Slave, Selma, like these films that focus largely on the hardships of the African American experience and the Black experience.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of discussion within the African American community where some people, they're pretty much tired of it. Like, they don't want to hear these sad stories anymore.
Yeah.
I, for one, don't believe that.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I know all there is to know about it for me to have had enough
right.
of it. But I'm just curious as to how you feel about that, having read a book that's focuses largely on a lot of these hardships mm-hmm. within our history. How do you feel about the story being told again, or the value in it being told again and people hearing it again?
You know, it was really important to me that this book end up in the present, in part for that reason, to kind of to show, you know, what all of this has meant to us today. I think a lot of those books and movies, they kind of end at a certain point. 12 Years a Slave ends with him going back and seeing his family again, which is great, but that wasn't the story for most people who were taken through the Fugitive Slave Act. And so I wanted to kind of be able to follow things through to the present. And the other thing that I wanted was to be able to look at the great stories, the more joyful, more powerful stories in our history. There's a chapter in this book that takes place around the Yaa-Santua War. And Yaa-Santua was this figure in Ghana who was very much like Joan of Arc. You know, she rallied her people against the British, and yet most people don't know her name, and so I wanted to speak her name in this book. And so that was a part of it, too, to kind of balance both sides, not just the tragedy, but kind of our moments of resilience and uprising and all of that. Yeah.
Next question? Tell us about the title, Homegoing.
Sure. So homegoing, historically, for, you know, it's a term that traditionally was used for slave funerals, the idea being that once a slave died, his or her soul got to return home to their African country, wherever it was that they came from. And so that felt particularly resonant for me with this book because, well, I won't spoil the ending, but, you know, both the idea of being able to see your family again or the idea that you can connect to something that you've lost. And so that's kind of how I came upon that title.
And then over here.
Hi, my name is Kukwano, and I'm a Ghanaian.
Hi.
Hi. A couple of questions that are non-sequiturs there, really. Did you learn Chi? Did you learn the language today, or did you lose it?
That question's kind of complicated. I can understand it pretty well, but I don't speak it at all. And I think what happened was that when we came to this country, like, my father's also a French professor, and we learned French as children too, and so our languages were all muddled, and so we started kind of, they would speak to us in one language, and we would answer back in English because we were having trouble in school. And so now my brain just works that way. If I hear Chui, I understand it, but I can't, okay. I can't speak it as well.
Yeah, I also studied French, but I haven't read the book, but I read the review in the New York magazine, mm-hmm. and that's why I came, and I wanted to congratulate you. And one of the things that impresses me are the Ghanaian names in the book, mm-hmm. at least, you know, those that you mentioned, and I want to congratulate you for this feat.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
Good evening. Thanks for your creativity and what must have been a very painful research activity. You've confirmed my suspicion that third culture kids have some sort of incremental creativity as a result of that.
Yeah.
Maybe you can comment on that. But I'm also curious a little bit about the tribal anthropology in Ghana at this time, with the Fante Asante Iwe, mm-hmm. and how was it vertically structured? Where was the power? All three tribes were involved in kidnapping or the trading. Mm-hmm. How did it come about? And was it vertically structured? Were the Fante the powerful? And which tribes were the exploited?
Well, there were numerous different ethnic groups involved in the slave trade in different aspects. The Ashanti were allied with the Dutch, and the Fanti were allied with the British. And so the Fante kind of lived on the coast and were the kind of the last stop before you got sent to one of these castles. And the Ashanti lived in the inland. I only focus on those two ethnic groups in the book because those are the two ethnic groups that I know best. My father is an Ashanti and my mother is a Fante. So beyond that, beyond the scope of that, I'm not exactly sure. But yeah.
And isn't there an element of colonialism and even saying tribes and...
Yeah.
Because that's not something that's indigenous to the continent, right? The way that things were chopped up have to do with map making and resource gathering. It's not
exactly
an inborn thing. So I don't know if you're asking about hierarchy, so I don't know if it works that way, right?
Right.
Could be more... not hierarchical. It could be maybe based on geography or resources that are close by or specialties, But the resources of economies, that's a framework that we're looking at. We're imposing on something that may not have existed, right?
So you spoke to having to navigate or straddle between your first generationness, your Africanness, your African Americanness, and this being a part of that discovery process.
Yeah.
So on the other side of this, what is the conversation you're having with yourself about your identity or sort of where you exist through this process?
I think, you know, I lived for years with this kind of imposter syndrome thing. And I think this book was kind of just me giving myself permission to feel fully both, you know, fully both Ghanaian, fully...
Both and.
And, right, like not a subtraction, but an addition. And that's kind of what I learned through writing this book, is that I can claim both identities, my racial identity and my ethnic identity.
Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
What's next for you, and what kinds of stories would you like to write?
I am working on another novel. I try to kind of start something after I've finished, kind of set something else aside. So I started it after I finished the first draft of this book, which was nice because now I have something to go back to, and I don't have to kind of start from nothing. I think I'm, you know, this is my first book, but I think I can already tell that each time you write a novel, you kind of have to learn how to do it all over again. So it feels very different. I probably won't talk about what it's about because I'm superstitious in that way, but it's different.
Hi, I just, more Aiko, you've done well.
Thank you.
I lived in Ghana in 2005 for 6 months, and I had the opportunity to visit the Cape Coast castle and go through the doors of no return and come back.
Yeah.
And I grew up in South Central LA. I'm first generation Mexican American. I married a Ghanaian.
Mm.
I have an 8-month-year-old baby who we're, you know, trying to teach both the Ghanaian culture and the Mexican culture. And so I feel, and I haven't read the book, that this is going to be very important for him. So hopefully when you do sign it, you get to sign it for my son, Eli Kim.
Sure.
So, medasipa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Unless there's any burning, we have one more burning question, then we're going to wrap things up right up here.
Sorry. I actually sort of created my own timeline when I started the book. So I did that with when I read 100 Years of Solitude because there was so much repetition in the names.
Yeah.
And when I saw yours, I tried to find the roots as much as possible. The only thing I could really find was on Wikipedia. So it was sort of the day that they were born in some general route, like peace or fertility. So how deliberate was your process of actually naming the characters? Or was it just more familiarity or more of the intention of like naming the characters is what I'm asking.
Yeah, some of the names, like some of the names were family names, so those were easy. Like James Richard Collins just got his name from his grandfather. But then for some of the other names, like I don't know as much about Ghanaian naming traditions, and so I had my dad help me with some of that stuff. And you know, there are the day of the week names, like Ya, my name is the name given to a girl born on Thursday. So those names were kind of easier, but some of the other names I kind of had to figure out in a different way. But yeah, there wasn't too much deliberation about it. It was kind of just when I landed on something that sounded right or felt right, that's what I went with.
In other words, they named themselves.
They named themselves. Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're gonna go into the lobby and have a book signing. Thank you all so much for coming. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Loud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, National Endowment for the Arts, and Aaron Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.